Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Ireland's fullback Hugo Keenan pipped an Irish back rower to the Player of the Match award on Saturday, and there can be no higher praise in Irish rugby than that. Welcome to Monday Six Nations podcast. Hey, Murph. Hey, Si.
Hey, Owen.
That's how good he was, Owen. That's how good he was.
You have to be 50% better than the back rower in order to get the man.
Forget about it. I mean, but he wasn't one of those Man of the Match awards where they gave it to a centre for doing all the things that a back rower does, you know?
auxiliary flanker.
Yeah, you can have back row player of the match awards, but then you can have also, like, you know, conceptually speaking, back row. So, like, a second row wins, but also that's mainly because he's an auxiliary flanker. Also, centres, see below. But no, when you're as good as Hugo Keenan, doing even non-back row things... Yeah. That's how good he was.
And it's one of those as you're watching it, all the little moments mount up in your head, and then you go, ah, but he probably made a mistake at some point. But then the lads who pour over these things two, three replays, Hugo Keenan made no mistakes in that game.
He made no tackles either. No tackles whatsoever, but he did pretty much everything else. Jumping above men twice his height to claim high balls, chasing down Welsh speedsters to save certain tries and the likes. And I have to say, I've seen it written in a lot of places that Keenan beat the Welsh flyer Rio Dyer in a foot race in saving that try. In defence of the young Welsh speedster. Would you go speedster or flyer, Murph? I go speedster.
Well, I would have gone with tyro, but that's a slightly different meaning. So, no, okay. I mean, speedster is fine by me.
In his defence, I should point out, he was busy trying to dribble a rugby ball, football style, toward the try line as he was being chased down. So just to be fair to young Rio Dwyer.
He actually hesitate, though.
Who did? Dyer?
Dyer did, just as it was kind of crossing the try line, whereas Keenan was going like an arrow for the ball. Dyer, and I know Dyer had to react and he had to kick and all that sort of stuff, but there was like a millisecond, barely perceptible, where he actually could have dived and maybe got under Keenan, but Keenan was way more decisive, basically.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say impressed me the most, how decisive he was, but more so his touch. As he decides, I'm diving over the line full pelt, there's going to be no dilly-dallying here. But then, that's risky, because how often do you see that ball spill then? And then somebody else just comes along and, oh, I'll just dot this down. So for him to just sprint at that speed, slide over the line under that kind of pressure and just take the ball was just one in a number of kind of ridiculous moments that he had over the course of the game. You must be happy enough, Si, overall, are you?
Yeah, and the way Ireland are playing away from home, like they started really well against New Zealand, started really well here, and it just has this multiplier effect where it obviously kills the crowd, it puts scoreboard pressure on the opposition team straight away, it calms us, and you actually play a different game when you're ahead, particularly 14 points as opposed to, say, 7. You can actually start to play a slightly more tactical, calm style of play, and your tactics change. So it sets the platform for the whole game. And Wales, I always felt we're going to come back into it in some way or another, but when the gap is that big, it was 17 points in the second half, you still have that room for error, and that makes you play a little bit better. You know what I mean? When you say, I have no room for error here, you're more likely to make an error. Whereas Ireland could actually make 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, which they did in the end. I actually was a little bit surprised by how rattled they were at one stage. But the lack of scoreboard pressure on Ireland in that second half was kind of the factor in us coming back and winning it easy in the end.
I did think it was funny at halftime the way Wales were completely dismissed, because I did assume, like you say, that they were going to mount some sort of a comeback. Mm. Do you remember that one we had years ago? Was it the one where Zeebo did that back heel?
That's the last time we won in Cardiff.
Yeah, but that was, we took a big lead in that one and they came back and we ended up having to win this absolute squeaker.
That's right.
If I recall that one correctly. So, you know, those thoughts were in your head.
Yeah, and there was the Liam Williams break where Tipperick threw an overhead pass that went into touch. That was a good chance for them to, I think, another score there, and we really were starting to look a little bit worried. There was the three try savers, or, you know, Welsh errors or Irish try savers in the first half as well. The Ringrose tackle on Bigger. Like, Bigger should have scored there. Bigger kind of hesitated as well and looked extremely slow. Ringrose is also brilliant, but I don't think Ringrose should have even had a chance to get a tackle in there. Either the pass had to go from Bigger or Bigger just get his own footwork going, because there was two defenders trying to scramble across in the space of maybe 2 metres to the line. So the Welsh did screw up, and they lost three lineouts near, or relatively near, the Irish try line as well. So they had chances. Our scramble defence was 100 times better than theirs. Like, their scramble defence was actually pretty bad. So I think the scoreboard actually did flatter Ireland a little bit. Now we were way the better team, but I don't think we were that much better. Or certainly our performance on the day wasn't that much better than Wales's.
Shane and Trimble on the show today to talk about that. Obviously, France almost got knocked off their stride straight off the bat yesterday against Italy, but they got through. So the result of the weekend, of course, goes to the Scots. Never doubt these lads, Murph. They will always, always deliver on big one-off occasions against England.
Is this like 4 wins in 5 games against England or something? It's unbelievable. And yet so believable all at the same time, isn't it? You know, watching it even from early on, he was like, yeah, this is totally a game the Scots could win. And it's just so, it is so convenient for us that Scotland are now hothousing their one brilliant performance of every Six Nations against the same team, England, which we're more than happy to see lose in any case. So it couldn't be working out any better, really.
Scotland haven't won their opening two games since the early 90s, and Scotland haven't won their opening two games, since the early 90s, and Wales haven't lost their opening two in about 15 years.
Who's up next for Scotland, Simon?
And actually, weirdly, Scotland play worse against Wales than pretty much any other nation, because I think they think they should be beating them.
Yeah, I mean, Wales are winning this game next week. Come on, like, everyone knows that. I mean, it's not even, I'm not even saying that as a gag anymore. Like, Wales will win that game next week.
Which leaves
everyone on, you know, and England will beat Italy, which leaves, like, kind of all of our Triple Crown rivals on one win each after two games, which is just how we like it. I mean, it's a good start.
Owen, if you could stop talking over Murph's hostage to fortune statements, please.
Yeah, indeed. Sorry, I'm just trying to get in here to just mention something here. I'm not so certain England are going to beat Italy, by the way.
That's going to be interesting.
Sean Dyche, I don't know if you saw much of him after the Everton, but since taking over at Everton and then after beating Arsenal, he's at pains in every interview to not be seen to be slagging off his predecessor in any way. It's always he prefaces almost every comment with, this is nothing about what came before me, but we're going to work hard and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Steve Borthwick has no such qualms about sticking the knife into poor Eddie Jones. When I looked at the team in the autumn, when I measured the team and got all the data for the team, we weren't good at anything. It was as frank as that. We weren't good at anything. It's the most cutting remark anybody has ever made about their own team.
It's unbelievable.
Well, not their own team, their predecessor's team, to be fair.
And Borthwick has a record of not saying anything ever as a coach. And he obviously worked under Eddie. I mean, he clearly loathes him. And that, it's also, obviously, when you say your predecessor got absolutely nothing right, you're basically giving yourself an excuse for a season as well. And England had about, I thought, 10 chances to win that game. And I mean, I know they're kind of mentally a bit weak at the moment as well, but like, structurally, they were all over the place. Their defense at times was a horror show. And like, there's one thing saying your predecessor, but you have had your team for a couple of months and you should make some impact, I think, in your first game. And that's quite a statement from a guy who doesn't say anything. It means 10 times more when you're a super safe Eddie, you know, or steady Eddie, I should say.
Yeah, unfortunately, the other Eddie wasn't steady enough by the sounds of things. This is our one bank. Oh, that's an awful segue. But anyway, this is our one bank holiday podcast today.
No such thing.
Ken is going to be back tomorrow with a brand new football pod for all our World Service members. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, featuring a bad weekend for Man City, failing to take advantage of Arsenal's slip, and now in the dock with the Premier League. The Premier League have charged them with breaching their financial rules on more than 100 occasions over multiple years. That's quite a few occasions. The Independent Commission, which will consider the charges, could recommend that City be expelled from the competition, suspended, or docked points if it finds the club guilty. So, yeah, quite a lot for Ken to consider on Tuesday's football podcast, which will be exclusively for World Service members. You can sign up now, secondcaptains.com, €5 a month plus VAT.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Back to Campbell, back to Duggan. McLaughlin going for that line, and Ireland are in and over.
A first Ireland win in a decade in Cardiff. The Scots doing England, and the Six Nations actually looking like it has Six Nations in it now, with Italy putting it up to France. Not a bad opening weekend, was it, Andrew Trimble?
Oh, it was brilliant. It was great. It was suspiciously perfect from an Irish perspective, and now it makes me irrationally worried.
Why do you say it was perfect? Are you throwing in the France struggles there as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, France were our big worry, and then we're also reminded that there's no quick fix to England, and France, you know, potentially, you know, it could be bad for us, but certainly on the surface of it, they don't look like they look like they're not quite maybe where they were. Something could click very easily with France. I'm certainly not saying France are the team of old, but we're in good shape, I think.
Although I feel my analysis is being influenced massively by my own issues. I'm scared of my own shadow at the moment. I built that Welsh team up to be incredible.
Everyone did.
You know, both we were speaking about it last week on the show, and then pre-match, I'm thinking, oh, Gatland's back, and he's gone to the old crew, and it's, you know, the Cardiff Arms in Cardiff, the Millennium Stadium, haven't lost there in 10 years. They'll be right behind them, and just blew them off the pitch. It was barely a competition.
I think you're trying to override all the times we've been caught out by underrating Gatland.
That's exactly that's what I was going to say. So, like, how many 10-15 years of saying there's no way that Welsh side is going to win the Six Nations, no way that Welsh side is going to win a Grand Slam, and they continued to do it time and time again. And now I think we're going to have 10 years or 15 years of us saying, whoa, there's something uncertain about this Welsh side, and we're going in there irrationally nervous. Even Sexton saying this is the most nervous he's ever been for a test match.
And I thought, the images before the game in the changing room, so they weren't the immediate images. Apparently now Farrell does the team talk. It used to be done by Joe in the hotel, but he now does it in when they first get off the bus, and I just looked tense. I looked fired up. I was like, you know, so yes, you want that, but it made me super nervous. And I think we've just got this hangover that I know lots of Irish teams have been favourites for a long time now, but I still do think we have this residual hangover of much preferring to be underdogs and it's sitting better with us. Certainly, you know, maybe as, you know, my generation of analysts, maybe less so Trims than the players at the moment, who just look very confident and mature and able to deal with what they're used to. But this is just a big change. And even the way we're being perceived, I was reading some comments during the week about how much other teams don't like Ireland. And I don't mean that in a they don't like playing against them, but they just don't like them. They think we're up ourselves. They think You know, it's everything that comes with being success. You know, all the teams that we played against that we didn't like for maybe irrational reasons. You can see some of the other teams who gave us a much easier ride over the years are now going, I don't like these guys, and it's because of the success.
Yeah, at the start of the start,
it's not
the start
just Leinster.
Of the game, I just want to get to know Andrew.
It's sure not just Leinster.
Well, I tell you what, it's not. It's not Ulster.
the start of the game killed all that. That's the thing. And you know, Ireland have done this to better teams in the last 12 months than Wales. They did it in New Zealand on more than one occasion. It's a happy knack to have, Andrew, isn't it? To get in there, especially in an away game, and just kill all the atmosphere, do all that, and put doubts in the other team's minds straight off the bat.
Yeah, the Gatland factor just goes out the window immediately. The Principality Stadium and the crowd and the intensity, again, out the window, and they just nullify the whole thing really quickly. And then and then they get on with the rest of the game. And it's actually, it was a bit of an arm wrestle for periods, you know, 20 minutes, certainly probably more in the second half. And it could have been, it could potentially been in the balance if Wales had scored one or two of those opportunities, and they didn't. But it just felt like, as you say, scoreboard pressure, and it looked like Wales were chasing the game, which could potentially have brought a good version of Wales out, but they weren't up to it in the end. And it's that fast start, it just sets a tone really early. We're in charge here, we're dictating the pace of this game, and the pace of this game is going to be played 100 miles an hour whilst we have the ball. The speed of the ruck was through the roof. And it wasn't even just the style. I think you might have been forgiven for thinking that the intensity and the pace and just the tempo to Irish play might have been an expansive play. Yes, there was a bit of expansive play, but a lot of it was runners off nine. But it was just the sheer pace of the breakdown. Their shape must have been so good. They very rarely got hit hard. Even when they did get hit hard, Keelan Doris, I'm thinking a couple of times, just spun nicely and then just made a few extra yards, which made that next breakdown really difficult for Wales to slow down. And Ireland just went from strength to strength. When they had that tempo, they just looked like they were undefendable. I thought
that start is a really good habit to get into, and they're in it now. It's been a very long time since they started badly, and it just turns down the opposition atmosphere and stadium in a massive way. You know, we're talking about Farrell saying that he wanted the roof closed because of the atmosphere. Well, hard luck, because the team's performance in the first 10 minutes made sure there was no atmosphere there at all. Roof open or closed, it didn't make a difference. It just sapped the energy out of the stadium, and that's exactly what you want to do. And that's what you want to do more than expose yourself to a cauldron type atmosphere and then have to get out of that. They had a bit of it in the second half, but it's the best way to stop it. But Trims, you're right, it wasn't particularly expansive because it didn't have to be. Now, they were set up to be expansive at different times. And we saw Porter in the Tadhg Furlong role carried a little bit more. Now, he doesn't have as good as hands of Furlong. But yeah, and it's not, and that's not a massive criticism, because nobody does. You know, there's plenty of backs that don't have good hands as Furlong, so you have to see it in that light. But what was happening was they were getting so much go forward. Their shape was so good. Their carries were so good. Their clean outs were brilliant. So we've spoken a lot about that little triangle that they make, which can go to one of three. It generally goes to the middle man. He can drop it inside, outside, or pull it out the back for the guy looping around. It can be nine, or it can be further out, it can be a 10. The carries were so good, and the meters after contact were so strong, that the guy either side of the carrier were the first into the ruck. You didn't need anybody else. So you've got the threat there, and you don't have to have it resourced by anyone else. Huge tempo. I think there was a stat in the middle of the half. It was funny, just as we were talking about in studio, the stat came up. Ireland had, I think, 70% of their rucks were between 1 and 3 seconds. And I would say, you know, of that, you know, at least 70% were about 1.5. You know, it was so, so fast. So there was a natural tempo in the game. And it was interesting, the one time, I think it was in the second half, I got quite frustrated. It was the time that Conor Murray box kicked the ball almost from almost midfield. And it was obviously a pre-planned play. But they had, it was from a line out that was just outside our 22. And I can see why they did it, because it's a way of exiting. But the first carry off the line-out was so good. Then there was a second carry, then an extra ruck off that, the first ruck. There was a massive yards made. And at that stage, we'd made up 40 metres. And it was like, oh, just play. You don't have to go through with the box kick option at that point. And it was because, you know, Wales were so soft and we carried so well and rucked so efficiently. So from that perspective, we didn't see the more expansive game, but maybe it was because we didn't need to see it.
I was struggling to work that out as well with that box kick. It felt like they didn't stumble across it. It looked like they were going to it specifically. And I was kind of racking my brains. Is that Josh Adams is good in the air? Liam Williams is good in the air? Halfpenny, before obviously the game plan would have been designed around him, they're all good in the air. I didn't really understand the rationale, but like everything they touched turned to goal, even that, even though it seemed like suboptimal, you know, strategy, even that worked for them.
Yeah, it was definitely a pre-planned move, Trims. They had, if you looked at the way, even the shape, they had, I think, maybe four down the short side, all super flat, nobody able to take a ball. It was done, you know, I'm not actually blaming Conor Murray, because I think under those circumstances you go, oh, listen, that's Murray kicking again. That's not, it's a strategy, but they maybe haven't just reacted, the whole team hasn't reacted to the fact that they've made 30 yards here, don't need to kick the ball.
I sometimes feel like, say those opening 20 minutes with Ireland, and you feel the dominance, but there was no one outstanding play, as you both alluded to there. It was just a series of perfect accuracy and people doing their jobs right. But I sometimes feel you need to go back and look at somebody like Murray Kinsler or Brett Igoe or these guys who show you the exact clip and why something happened. And one of them was just a beautiful James Ryan line off Sexton. Now, Sexton had to read it well as well. But what struck me about it was, and we always give the praise to Sexton, and he was good again, not amazing, but good. But that James Ryan's line and timing of the run and decisiveness and aggression demanded the pass. And that these guys, I know they know their job so well, but there's talent in that we kind of underestimate. The ability to time that run, to time the angle, to judge the moment. And basically Sexton has no choice but to give that pass because it's such a perfect run.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where it's, not even is it just that element, and you know, kind of four or five different factors all contributing to James Ryan finding space in that gap on the inside of Sexton, but even like three, four, five phases before, there's enough questions being asked of the defense for Ken Owens to sit down and maybe create that space outside from two phases earlier. And I think this happened in attack and defense with Ireland, that they had so many options, so many live options, so many guys know.
And Wales know that. Like they're worrying about Ringrose and lower wide. They're worrying about what Sexton does short. They're worrying about the loop. They've 10 questions in their head as they're facing the Ireland attack.
Absolutely. And all like, only one of those questions is valid because only James Ryan ended up with the ball. So having said that, the other ones could become live very quickly if they make decisions in defence. But it just feels like there's enough detail in Ireland's attack to have all of that variety of options, but there's enough heads up to know which option to pick. And I hate people who talk about, you know, the post-Schmidt era. Get away from detail. You have to have that detail to understand or to have those options available. But you have to have, you know, the Farrell contribution, which is play heads up and see what's the best option. So that was an attack. In defence, even that, you know, slightly difficult period for Ireland in defence, you know, I think James Lowe gets the credit twice for the intercept and then the tackle that Ringrose made, and then he got on the turnover.
On Bigger, yeah.
On Bigger, yeah. And the first one, for example, is a good example where Ringrose shoots up twice in defence and just makes them make a suboptimal decision. Actually, Beelum came up as well. So three times in the four or five phases up until Lowe's intercept, those guys are planting the seed. They're making it difficult for them. And then eventually Lowe gets up, makes one more read. So it looks like they've got a nice license. Again, the detail to have the shape in defence, but then the onus on the individual to make a read and get up and get in the space and just make it really tricky. Like even right up when you watch the replay with Lowe, who is he on? He's kind of in between. He's just putting himself in a difficult position. Same thing with Ringrose. It looked like he had actually made the wrong decision, but he's right in between two attackers, and his recovery is incredible. I thought Ringrose was the unsung hero at the weekend. He did so much with ball in hand and in defence as well. But you can see how Joe Schmidt always used to say, good players make other players look good. And I think they've got a lot of guys fulfilling that role.
Just to go back briefly to that, the couple of phases before the James Ryan big carry, and we actually pulled it out in studio, didn't get time to do it. But to Andrew's point, there was a line from Tadhg Byrne, which is an absolute screamer. And for all the world, I thought he was going to get it, and it flashed across him and went to the second man. And that doesn't seem like a big deal, but it's a massive deal because it sat down, everyone's you know, looking at that you have to respect Byrne when he's coming like that. You can't not respect him. And that just makes things a little bit easier. The other thing was Byrne ran that line but managed to get back into the ruck as well, which is the detail that Andrew is saying, you know, because if you don't go into that ruck, then that may, all of a sudden that gets turned over or it has to, you know, you burn another man on it. So from that, you know, that perspective, though, that subtleties I thought were really impressive from Ireland. The other thing on defence, you're right on Lowe. He was up there in the middle and he didn't really have anyone, but it felt comfortable enough. It's like there was no way the Welsh players could get the ball through because of the position that he had taken. And you know, that's, I think that was one of the positives as well. He looked relatively comfortable, I thought, and he doesn't always look comfortable. Ringrose, I thought we saw a slightly different Ringrose. Like, he's brilliantly reading that line in behind and he's given free rein to do it. But he seems to have upped his speed, you know, since the autumn by a magnitude as well.
Now, as in line speed you're talking about.
Oh, he's flying so fast that he missed a couple, you know, or just got like a weak arm on them. Now, I think that's a tactic, because what you do is you go, even if I don't make the tackle, I've put the guy under so much pressure. He's not going to make the pass. He's not going to be comfortable with what he's doing. He's not going to be able to sidestep me. I won't let him in my inside, so he can only beat me really on one way. Or I'm going to slow him down, and then the other players can fill in. So it's a calculated risk. It is a risk, but it's calculated. And players find it very difficult to deal with that. So it would be interesting if he keeps that on, if the French identify it, and if they can counteract it. That's kind of the interesting things for me. The other thing that he need to tighten up on Matt Hansen, who had some astonishing moments and as good an offloading as maybe, you know, you will see through the tournament, and shows the difference in an offloading game, what it can do, how it can break down defences. But he'd looked uncomfortable a few times and he got caught a few times right on the edge. And you know, Sexton certainly gave it to him at least one time, because Sexton was in covering him behind. But a little bit of work to be done there as well, because I thought they got around us too easy on a couple of occasions.
Yeah, so all those things generally went right for Ireland. And then I was surprised, Andrew, with how rattled we looked when the pressure did come on in the second half. And Wales created some of that pressure, but I'm thinking like Porter not rolling away, Porter jumping on Williams when the try was clearly already scored. Three or four kind of silly penalties. Sexton kicking that ball wide from his own 22. I felt like we lost it for a little while there. And considering our lead and considering we've won 18 games in the last 20 and all that sort of stuff, it surprised me that Ireland could be rattled in that game.
Yeah, and Porter in particular, maybe I'm wrong, but my perception of Porter, he's not an ill-disciplined player, and he's certainly not a guy who does kind of cheap shots, as what he did in Liam Williams. I don't think you need to get called out by Warren Gatland in the press conference after the game, to be fair. But my impression of the penalty count, whenever people talk about the penalty count, they're giving them cheap access points, cheap penalties, sloppy penalties, is because they're receiving a lot of pressure and they're absorbing that pressure, and eventually that tells. So it's not necessarily the ill discipline, it's the pressure. But on that occasion, they were sloppy. It was specifically their ill discipline. Porter, like, really unlike him just to give away those cheap penalties. No need. He just needs to get out of there quickly. And then that one on Liam Williams, there's no need at all.
I thought he was clearly scored. Pretty committed to that.
Which one are you talking about? I thought they reacted to the Porter one or the try.
I thought, I didn't see much in that. And like, two things. One, I didn't see much in it. I thought, you know, it's someone who's committed, who's, you know, scrambling, and potentially, is there any chance of, you know, is there like a 5% chance of getting the ball knocked away or getting released? I think that's where that is. So I had no issue with it, actually. I think it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not saying it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't dangerous, but, you know, don't give the ref an opportunity to give another penalty against you.
But, like, it's easy to say that, Simon, but it's, you know, these guys are playing at the super edge, right? They're trying to maximise every bit. They're squeezing the pips out of every opportunity. And then it's very difficult just to say, oh, listen, you know, don't go in for that. They're hardwired to go in for that. And I didn't mind that so much. And also, I didn't mind Mac Hansen coming in afterwards. I thought, I loved it, actually. I was like, that just shows something. Too often, I think, a bit more, we're sort of automatrons as well. And one of his players was getting it, and he went in. He didn't do anything too crazy to get sent off, but he got in and he backed his players, and the rest backed it. And I just thought, that's a good side of Ireland as well. And Ireland don't always have that. and it's back. And I know they gave away a penalty, and I know it put them under pressure, but I don't know. The fact that they, you know, they were comfortable enough in the game, they were going to win it, they have won it now. I think that kind of stuff, I know it's a little bit of, you know, pseudoscience, old school, but I actually think
I don't know, Shane, if I think Wales screwed up that line out. If they'd gotten that and there was more pressure in our 22, we start giving away more penalties, maybe the yellow card, then you're talking a different game potentially. And I do think the scoreboard didn't fully reflect the chances Wales had. I know it was brilliant scramble defence from obviously Keenan, Ringrose and Lowe, and Lowe's intercept and all the rest, but I still don't think Ireland were that much better than Wales. I think Ireland actually can play way better than they did against Wales.
Yeah, they can certainly play more consistently for longer. Although having received that pressure for 25 minutes, you know, reasonably relentlessly for 20 minutes, well, Wales had a lot of possession, a lot of opportunities. Ireland's scramble was incredible. That wouldn't have got tested if they hadn't have been there. And then Ross Byrne coming back on, I think he pretty much kind of coincided with turning the game back again, and Ireland just regaining control. That's a real skill. Whenever you're on the receiving end, it's kind of more natural for Wales to chase the, you know, to chase the game, concede a few penalties or a few tries, and then start chasing the game. And then just the tendency is it's easier for them to start, you know, change that tide. It feels like it's our turn. But the other way around, whenever Ireland were in front and they had to go after that bonus point, and they had to kind of stall that Welsh momentum, that's a real skill. And everybody's, you know, there's a lot of chat about the, I forget the name of the guy, the Leinster mental skills coach who's in there doing a bit of work. It just feels like Ireland can cope with a lot of stuff. Granted, they lost control in the first place, but it's totally unrealistic in Six Nations, as Wales are not, they're not what they were. Certainly there's a lot of old guys there. Maybe Warren Gatland isn't what I don't know, but you can't expect Ireland to go 80 minutes. Wales at home are always going to have that purple patch. France, even in Dublin next week, will always have that purple patch, and that's tested our scramble. I think it's we've been tested twice. Can we scramble? Can we maintain control? And then can we take back control whenever it's our turn to kind of shift the momentum of the game again? And I think Ireland passed both those tests.
And a couple of things, it did coincide with a yellow card as well. You know, the yellow card was given away, so I think we did see that change there, as opposed to maybe a complete, you know, mental flip and rewriting the ship. So you know, maybe that's still out there to be fully tested. I thought maybe he was a little bit slow on the bench as well.
Ross Byrne.
Yeah, I think he could have got Ross on earlier. You know, but I was surprised. I don't know if he eventually took out Peter O'Mahony, but he wasn't having a massively influential display. He didn't have that many actions in the game, so I was surprised that he continued on. I don't know the trust. He definitely has trust in Herring, and Herring has shown that he's trustworthy as well. But I think there was a reluctance to use the bench fully, which was, I think, counted against Ireland and something that, you know, we probably can't do against France, because you have to use all your numbers, and you have to go, like, this is our squad. And even though this guy's a great player, he's left everything out there for, you know, 60, 70 minutes. And this other player, maybe not, you know, if they're both starting from zero, may not be as good, but this guy is going to be more impactful just because of fatigue. So, you know, I think that's definitely a point as well. So, you know, whether they were able to change that mental switch or not, I still think has to be tested. But it was interesting. Farrell identified, I can't remember if he said before or after the game, but one of the interviews, he was saying that period, that, you know, it's very maybe trite to say a purple period, but in the Six Nations, teams just don't roll over, or you just don't have a perfect match. You don't dominate a match from the first minute to the last minute. And it's how you deal with that period where you're out of, you know, you're out of dominance, and they're having that period. It's how you deal with that.
That James Ryan line out steal.
What a great moment.
That's a perfect moment.
What a great moment. Great moment. And there was a couple of those, actually, that Ireland, you know, flipped it on its head. But Ireland do play with long periods of dominance. But don't expect Ireland, you know, either in Six Nations games or certainly the World Cup against big teams where they own the ball for 80 minutes. It's just
the compound errors. Really,
have we mentioned Hugo Keenan yet, Andrew? How good is this guy?
Yeah, he's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Actually, sorry, ridiculous, but kind of low-key ridiculous, because he doesn't do, there's no moments of, wow, that's a highlight reel, but he just does time and time and time after again. He just gets in the air, plucks the ball, makes a good decision with ball in hand, makes a good defensive read, scrambles really well. He's such a tidy player. He just tidies up everything. Everything that's asked him, he executes perfectly. He's so, so reliable. And even that description kind of sells him short. He's yeah. reliable, but he does everything in a really classy way. He stood up, and I think the tendency of where Irish rugby is and where Irish rugby's been in the past, and he just looks like a guy who's growing. He knows how big the next 12 months are in front of him. He knows where his stock is at the minute. And he's just took another step up in a difficult environment. Maybe not a team that's firing all cylinders, but a lot of questions were asked of him, and he answered every single one of them. He's got a level of class, I think, that's and kind of a reflection of where this team is going and where they are currently as well.
I think that back three can go even further and counter. You see glimpses of them. They switch it on and off, but consistently I think they can get to a higher standard of when the ball is kicked and what they could do. Keenan is incredibly good at covering the backfield. The actual amount of meters that he puts up in a game is astronomical. So, you had someone like Rob Kearney there before, who that was his trade, and it's hard to overstate how good he was at that and how not good other people necessarily are at doing that, and how some, so it's definitely learned behavior, but it's also there's a sort of innateness about it. Keenan has it. He covers the backfield brilliantly, gives a lot of comfort to his two wings as well, which is important. He's absolutely ice cool under the high ball. He took one ball. I think it was a penalty because one of the players blocked on the way back. But he went up and had to change mid-air in the style of catching it because I think he either took a bit of a knock or the ball, I think his run was impeded. And I just thought, he still caught the ball. Yeah. It was a remarkable bit of skill that wouldn't really even be noticed.
He caught one off his boots as well in the Irish 22, and then immediately sidestepped somebody.
No, that was the thing.
Won the collision.
That was the thing, Simon. I saw him catch that ball, and just when I kind of shouted out at the television, I said, "Oh my God." And what you do normally, you catch that ball, you suck it into your bread basket, and then you dive into the ground head first. That's what happens, because you secure the ball. He picked it up, took two steps inside, made 15 yards, I'd say, perfect placement, and Ireland had another phase.
Yeah, the only other point on Hugh Keenan's worth saying is, talking about their defence, and Farrell's obviously giving guys a licence, and Ringrose took the piss out of that licence because he gets up, makes decisions. He's very, very brave in defence. If you're a winger outside Ringrose, you need someone as reliable behind you because you're going to test him. The wingers are going to try and get up. They have to, as a winger, depends on where you are on the pitch and where the ball is, but you have to have a balanced level of investment in what's inside you in the front line and then what's behind you in 15. So you're kind of looking at Ringrose and you're looking at Hugo Keenan and you're trying to just balance up how where you are invested in terms of your position on the pitch and where you're contributing that to. So if Ringrose makes decisions and shoots, you have to shoot with him. You have to get there on his shoulder because the only other option is for someone to tip something on. So wingers are pulled both directions and they know they can do that. They know they can put Hugo under pressure because he's going to back them up and he's going to close the gate outside them. And it takes a lot to be in position. There's obviously a lot going on there, a lot of work's going on, but it looks very clear.
Trims, what do you think about that counter-attack thing? Because we know James Lowe is predisposed to counter-attack. He loves an offload. He's got the power to get through. Keenan's well able to counter-attack as well and does more so than sort of a Rob Kearney. His balance of his game is better. And then Mac Hansen in the last 20 minutes of that game absolutely eating it up on these phenomenal offloads. I don't get the feeling, though, that they're quite as connected as a back three as they might be, or as they're not delivering as much as they could in that area.
Yeah, they probably didn't. There were no big moments where the ball was kicked to them. Bigger probably didn't kick maybe as loosely as might have, they might have provided those opportunities, or maybe a broken kind of kick chase. yeah, they maybe that could have been a reflection of they maybe just didn't get those opportunities. But they're both sniffing and they're both kind of keen. Certainly the wingers and Hugo as well, kind of pulling that all together. They're definitely keen, looking for opportunities. If those opportunities,
it's one of the most creative back threes we've ever had. Notice that. it is though. Like the three
of
like,
audience here.
The two wingers in particular have great vision. So there is huge scope, as you say, Shane.
Yeah, I think they're very ambitious players. They're exciting. They're keen on running. And they're, you know, they like to keep the ball alive. Those two, the two wingers in particular, I think Keenan, you know, he's certainly not risk averse, but he's a little bit more controlled than those two guys. But I suppose my overall feeling in with them is that there could be so much. And when you're playing in a back three that's really humming, You're working. You're almost praying for a loose kick. You're praying for a ball because you have your in your mind. You sort of know how your counter is going to go. You're going to go, well, it's kicked to the wing. It's going to, you know, we're going to pass it back in, long pass back in. We're going to bounce to the short side, or we're going to go two passes, one back, or, you know, we're going to do a little loop play, and someone's going to come on a short line. And then it was one of my favorite things about being in a back three that you've under those circumstances you really felt like a team, and you felt like you could have a bit of fun with the game. You know, that was the area where you got to get a bit of a head up. You got to maybe throw a little show and go on the return. You got to have that bounce when you're running an outside arc. It was just, it looks like it's the most fun period. And those, certainly the two wingers, seem like fun players, if that makes sense. They feel like guys who are quite joyous in the way they play.
Again, not as fun, you know, as us, Shaggy, I think is what, your
of course, the fun faction they used to call you guys. Just on the injury updates that we have.
Sorry. Comedy, I think, was different than fun.
Yeah, we have got injury updates just breaking this afternoon. Tyke Furlong, Jemison Gibson-Park and Keane Healy are all ruled out of the France game. Johnny Sexton to complete HIA process today. Ronan Kelleher back in training. So, you know, losing Furlong and Gibson-Park against a not very strong Welsh team is one thing, Andrew, but to go into the France game without them, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, will the Six Nations just continually be setbacks, and as Farrell will respond to this and say, what a brilliant opportunity to test ourselves. That's only
the happier
gets. That's only something you can say when you're winning, and maybe that's contributing, Shaggy, to that feeling outside. That's a little bit smug, is it not? You know, the bus is running late. Hopefully it's late. That'll be a great test for us.
he did actually say that, just for people, but he did say, I wanted it to be even later than it was, you know?
He's going to, like, you know, nick some of the players' boots, like just one boot. Just deal with it.
Missing studs, someone without a gum shield, just causing chaos in the changing room. There's a nice balance here, and I always hate the idea of giving guy an opportunity and someone growing into a role. And I think this is probably, hopefully, prove my point that you don't need to look for opportunities; those opportunities arise. And whenever you're provided with those opportunities, Conor Murray took his opportunity and just reminded us how good he is and how good he's been for so long. But he's someone who can go in there and play that high tempo game. Finlay Beelam, you don't need to look for an opportunity; you'll get opportunities, and he grew massively. I know, Shaggy, you were saying there about Porter stepping up and doing some of that, those tip ons and those decisions. But Beelam did that as well. I thought he did it really, really well. Contributed.
I
thought Beelam was. If not, I thought it was a toss-up between Doris and Beelam as the best player in the first half. I thought he was exceptional. Yeah. He was everywhere. He looked good. He was in that role. I think you're right. I think Porter was in it a bit more, but he was definitely filling it as well. And I remember he was filling that role, if you remember, in the autumn as well, when he came on. I don't know what it's Furlong. It's definitely Furlong, but it's also you know, the coaching setup, they've changed what the parameters of our prop are and what the expectations are. And in fairness, Beelam and Porter are a step.
Yeah, it's different against France, though, guys. This is my point, you know, and say particularly not having Gibson Park there, you know, you're against, I mean, we keep talking about Wales not being what they were. That's largely because Sean Edwards, in part anyway, that's Sean Edwards isn't there. He's with France now. So, you know, it is a game that you'd like that tempo that Gibson Park brings, I would have thought.
It is different, of course. France are different to every team out there at the minute, but any questions that have been asked about Ireland, and the other example, I suppose, is that, first of all, Beelam steps up. We've learned about Beelam. Conor Murray steps up, and we've learned about him. He can play with that high-tempo game. During the autumn, we learned about
Ross Byrne.
Exactly, Ross Byrne.
Best, I know it was only a few minutes, but probably his best spell for Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely, because it coincided with the kind of turn of the tide. Stuart McCluskey, we've learned about him. I think he rightly picked up his position. He started at 12. And I thought he was really good. He just looks way more rounded, all rounded. I just think he's someone you weren't like Henshaw. I think was unavailable for that South Africa game, and he came in. You don't need to force these opportunities. These opportunities will arise, and now plenty of them have risen up, and plenty of the guys have proved that they can play. So I think that's probably an extension of what Farrell's saying. If we get difficulties, then the guys will step up and they'll fill those boots easy enough.
What about the challenge by Shane, by that France are going to pose, do you think, Shane, particularly given how they struggled so badly yesterday?
Yeah, without reverting to stereotype, which, you know, you could do a lot of the Six Nations because they're so accurate, the stereotypes very often, but France do have been known to start slowly in the Six Nations, and Italy have been known to, you know, have that big performance in the first game, and very often do come up a little bit short, but have certainly a very strong period in that first game. So I wouldn't be reading too much into this is a sort of a lackluster France, yeah, or you know they nearly got turned over by Italy. I think that game will have done them, you know, a world of good. They'll be a better unit as a result of it. Their collective time together will have increased. They'll have another week with Edwards and Galtier. There'll be a little bit of a kick in the arse, but you know there'll also be a didn't we do well to come out the other side of it as well. So I don't think it's a, I think in many ways it's a positive for France coming out of that result. You know, what will Ireland look to do? I don't think they'll have changed anything week on week, having seen that, other than maybe reinforcing that France, like any team, don't like, you know, a sort of sophisticated multi-wave attack coming after them, you know, and that can, you know, that can pull them out of position, and they were probably as ragtag in defence as we'd seen them maybe over the course of the entire Sean Edwards era. So, you know, really Ireland will be looking to double down on what they're doing. You know, that what we saw against Wales, which was, you know, sort of perfect start, massively accurate, understanding we might not get as many yards in that first up areas because they, you know, France are more aggressive and more physical at being able to stop players dead, but recognising that we'll have to resource those rooks, and the players like Porter, Beelham, there's another role for you now, guys. You have to up that level. You need to be the furlong to link forwards with backs. Byrne as well will be looking at the same. And Conor Murray will have reinforced that. You know, he's not Jemison Gibson Park in terms of tempo, but, you know, he did exceptionally well, I thought. And, you know, I've been hard on Conor, you know, for the last time, for quite a long time, because he's not the player that he has been, that he once was. But I thought he did well, but he was helped by the, you know, the forwards making sure that our tempo was very good because they were very accurate at the breakdown. I also thought Casey was a bit disappointing when he came on. He looked like a guy who wasn't, he thought he'd have an extra second on the ball in everything he did. It was, this is Six Nations, mate, and you have to be instinctive almost. You can't be ponderous. You can't think about what am I going to do, what option am I going to pick. It's almost, you have to be so well drummed and so so instinctive that you just make the right decision without almost thinking about it.
I think Casey makes too many sniper runs where he gets caught. I think he thinks there's more space around, or maybe he just finds the pace of international rugby a bit more of a shock. And he hasn't had that many opportunities or that many minutes maybe. But too often he takes that risk where he takes a snipe and he's isolated. Now, he got away with it against Wales once, but he does it too often, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's a player that has had success at doing that at a lower level. And maybe thinks it's a little bit easier than it is. He's, you know, you don't want to drum that out of him.
No, I love it in scrum house, yeah.
You want to make sure he's doing it for the right reason. But, you know, there's... And so I'm relatively comfortable with Conor there. I think he recognises where that game has evolved to. There's a couple of moments that I would have thought, you know, experienced player that like the end of the first half should have been managed better. And you think, you know, when players talk about, oh, this guy's experienced, what does that really mean? It means making the right decision, you know, at the end of the first half in the situation we're in. And then secondly, you know, going back to the to the box kick. Like, although it was a pre-planned move, maybe that was something, if you're really experienced, you saw you made all these yards, maybe that's a call on the run to say, actually, cancel the power play and we'll just pick the option on the short side because we've got numbers there and we'll make momentum. So that's the, you know, the other side of things that we, you know, we want to develop. And I think he needs to have a big game against France, as they all do.
That's what I mean about Ireland. I think can play better than they did against Wales. I think Sexton could be better, and maybe Nerves or hasn't played that much rugby. I think Murray can be better. I think Peter Armani and Tyke Byrne can maybe get some more turnovers. I think we're going to need that against France. But I just wonder, Andrew, you know, Farrell has beaten everybody at this stage in the world besides France. And I hate this Six Nations being seen through the prism of the World Cup. But on this one occasion, I think it might be relevant in that he's lost three times. We've France at home. We're on a roll. They maybe have their eyes more on the World Cup than other nations do. That we kind of need to beat them? Or do you buy into that? Do you think it's totally separate from the World Cup? And if we lose, we'll still be okay?
I think it's totally separate. But I don't think it makes it any less important. A Grand Slam, they're few and far between, and there's an opportunity here. If they beat France this weekend, then it would be such a shock if they beat France and they don't win the Grand Slam. Even at this stage, I think...
Whoa. A shock if we don't win the Slam afterwards.
Yeah, I think if we beat France and we don't win a Grand Slam, having beaten Wales and France and got England at home the way England are playing, I think it'll be a shock.
Scotland away.
You're sensationalising this. You're trying to make this into like a
rotate against Italy.
Did anyone watch Scotland at the weekend? We haven't even mentioned them yet. Pretty impressive.
Scotland will do what Scotland do best. Shaggy.
I feel this is fine. The way they score that final try, going all through all those phases against England, away, full crowd, might just be the thing that finally changes their psychology. They haven't won the first two rounds of the Six Nations since the early to mid-90s, but I think this might finally be it.
That's not it, Simon. That's nope. Not what changes the psyche. What changes the psyche is the building on performance week on week on week, and that's what's always let them down. I know, listen, the way they won that game was really impressive. Their tries were like sensational. That Van der Merwe try was just,
well, which one? Because he scored two amazing ones, but the one where he danced around the number of opponents by himself. Yeah,
yeah, it was absolutely sensational. As good a try as you'll see ever. So yes, their in-game performance is better, but they've also been able to deliver some really, I think, really quality performances as one-offs. So it's three games in the trot. That's what they need to do. And until they do that, I'm not taking them seriously. Because every year I do, off the back of watching them in the autumn or watching them, you know, the year before, and, you know, coming out with a really good performance. And they, you know, listen, look at the... Scotland, I don't think, had beaten England. I saw a stat something recently at Twickenham. I think they'd won since 83 or something. It was something crazy. It was some really, you know, incredible stat. And they've won the last two, and I think it's drawn one and won two out of the last three. And so, you know, they're definitely capable of delivering, you know, big performances against big teams in the Six Nations. But it's not been back-to-back. And until they do that, They're not coming into my psyche anymore. They've messed me up for too many years.
Andrew, which was your favourite try? The one at the end where it went through several phases, still a brilliant finish from Van der Merwe, or the Jonah Lomu B5 defender?
Oh, Jonah Lomu. I was just watching it in the house by myself. Anna took the kids. They went, got them out of the house anyway. And I was just screaming. I couldn't believe it. It was incredible. And yes, the team try was amazing, and the intricacy and the detail and the off, everything was class. But the sheer pace, he is just a sight to behold. As you say, Jonah Lomu, he looked 100 miles an hour. Shaggy, we're talking about the Irish back three counterattack. There's very few players can do what he did. He took off 100 miles an hour. Then he has the wherewithal to put on a bit of footwork, and then the ball transfer, really, really sharp transfer to Dom Brandt, who had an absolute stinker. A poor fella. Like, he was going to be the last fella to miss the tackle on Van der Merwe, but it was unbelievable. It was an iconic try from a Scottish perspective, and the occasion, the Calcutta Cup and all, it was unbelievable. I thought it was a great advertisement for the Six Nations or for rugby in general.
But it's sometimes, you know, there's not many tries like that scored, but where there are those sort of phenomenal tries, you sort of get a sense, and those to the player, the player gets a sense as they're doing that. It's this is happening, and you can almost see it from afar. As the player can almost see it in their mind's eye, and the opposition can almost see it as well, because you know the panic comes on because he's got through that first line, oh, and he's done that and that step. He kept the step and he didn't hardly lose any pace. Then another step, and as you said, that should be it. It should be over, but it's because it was almost meant to be a try. He'd managed to transfer the ball and then had that super strong handoff, which propelled them forward as well. So he could get to the try line as well. So there are.
He wasn't looking for support either.
No, there are, and that's part of it, Simon. Yeah. You know that this
total
is happening.
Focus on
it's
the line.
It's just a moment that it's it almost slows down, and you're in this moment, and everything just starts going right, and it's build after build after build. It's astonishing. And there's not many moments like that happen or have happened in the Six Nations, but that will be, that'll be shown forever today, because that try was from a different planet.
I don't know if you see Borthwick's comments afterwards, Shane. He was talking about, he says, when I looked at the team in the autumn, when I measured the team and got all the data for the team, we weren't good at anything. Jesus.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, says
that
Eddie
quote.
Jones. Yeah.
It's not a very English thing to say either.
No.
And I don't know necessarily if, you're tapping into the psyche of that team, whether, that's the way you want to approach it. But, maybe he knows the people who are dealing with. Maybe they're the facts. I did see the stats for the previous Six Nations from Ireland, who were number one in, I think at least eight of the stats, maybe the ones they weren't number one in was, I think, only offloading and kicking. So, they are directly connected to, how successful your team are. But listen, I thought he was going to get, a bit of juice out of that English team. I thought it was, quite a nice setup to come into against a Scottish team that are a bit loose. Twickenham first game with new regime, everybody wanting them to do well, wasn't great. And Scotland weren't brilliant either. They had moments of brilliant, but they certainly weren't brilliant. And you did feel there was a couple of quite Scottish moments where ball should just go along the back. They get great width, and there's a couple of times they got really good width, and then there's a pass that's just shitty and it goes into touch or it's passed behind the back, and you think that's very, very Scotland-like. So it's not like this is a new Scotland we're seeing that,
there was the hog pass inside miss. There was Russell missing his kicks at goal. The one kicked out on the full. It felt like momentum killers three or four times, I thought. But England kind of didn't read that. They didn't sense that, hang on, we're the better team here and Scotland are making those errors. They didn't really capitalise on the usual Scottish frailty.
Yeah, I think that, and that shows a frailty to the English side as well, which, we talk about how do you wrestle momentum back in a game, but how do you wrestle momentum back in a tournament, and actually how do you wrestle momentum back over a longer period of time that hasn't been successful? You would have thought the jumping off point was on Saturday, but it clearly wasn't.
All right, guys, next Saturday should be a lot of fun. Thanks so much to the fun faction, Shane, Morgan and Adam Trimble.
Cheers, fellas.
Great stuff.
A lot of times you say something on this show and you're like, jeez, that could come back to bite me in the arse now, But like, I can just come out and say what I like about the Scotland rugby team. You'll never, ever get a chance to play audio back to me and be like, what were you thinking? How could you have come out and said such a thing?
Oh, Flood of Scotland, when will we see your like again?
Scotland are a disgrace to world sport.
That fought and died for
the Jots.
Your wee bit hill and glen,
and you cunts,
stood against him.
My name's Jackley McCaffrey.
Proud Edward's army.
You're always on the feeble tail. Never fit.
And sent him home.
The Scotland rugby team, the sporting world's greatest pinata.
They think again.
He's over the line, he's scored, and Scotland get the try they thoroughly deserve.
Like, I can sit here year after year and laugh at Scotland. Scottish rugby team, and I'll never be called out. It's an amazing freedom that I have.
Three Scotsmen. It's been that all day, and it's come loose, and Hamish Watson belted it into the sand, and that is it. And 38 years of hurt are over for Scottish rugby.
A reminder, our next football pod is on tomorrow exclusively for World Service members. Ken is off today. Old Glenn Early, huh? Licking his wounds after his boys, Watty Grahams, withdrew their objection, Murph. Watty Grahams, this came in on Friday night, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Watty Grahams, Glenn, lodged an objection to the result of the All-Ireland, blah, 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 because we believed that grounds existed for a replay to be held if Rule 644 had been broken. Due to the ongoing proceedings, we as a club now do not believe the conditions exist for a replay to be contested. Consequently, Watty Grahams, Glenn, would like to withdraw from this process. What changed from when they put the objection in to them now withdrawing the objection and saying the conditions do not exist for a replay to be contested?
Yeah, I've no idea. I've no idea why they did this. Well, the statement doesn't tell us why they did it. None of those words actually mean anything.
That's a really weird thing. Due to the ongoing proceedings, we as a club do not believe the conditions exist for a replay to be contested.
Due to the ongoing proceedings, because we've lodged an appeal, that means the grounds no longer exist for an appeal, is basically what that means. So I've no idea why the statement read like that. I mean, if they're withdrawing from the process, they say, to be honest, we've discussed this as a club and we just feel the right thing to do at this stage is to withdraw our appeal. Congratulations to Kilmacud Crokes, and we will hopefully see you back in the All-Ireland Club final next year. That's a statement, whether they meant a word of that or not, that makes sense to me in some way. I mean, what they came out and said, I don't know what that means. I mean,
just telling the truth. Just telling the truth in plain English. So why exactly they've gotten
Murph,
rid of it.
Murph, I read that as
they've withdrawn it would have been helpful. Sorry, Murph, Asaya.
I read that as them saying because Kilmacud have appealed and the process can drag on and on, there's no point anymore. Players go off and do different things, travel, change jobs, whatever it may be. And therefore, it's not
possibly. But they could have made that a lot clearer. You know, if the fact that we're having to debate.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
No congratulations to Crokes in the statement. Maybe there's a bit of a pop being had there. I don't know. It has been noted.
Yeah, I don't get it because I mean, like no one would probably no one would take it at face value anyway. But I mean, you throw it in one way or the other. I mean, because trying to read between the lines of all that, it appears to me that they may have got some legal advice to say, if this goes to the CAC and it rules in your favour, Crokes will go to the DRA and it will be taken off you in the DRA. So you can pull out now and... But again, if they'd gotten legal advice that kind of led them down that way of thinking, you would say that, right, okay, so if we're going to lose it anyway in the DRA, you might as well try and win the PR battle and say, listen, in the context of sportsmanship and 140 years of the GA being the unrivaled greatest amateur association in the world, we have decided to step away. We congratulate Kim McCrory, and you win the PR battle that way. I mean, when you release a statement like that, you're like, well, shag it, lads. You know, you might as well have gone to the DRA, and if you'd lost there...
You're only speculating about whether or not they got that advice.
Course,
but in terms of that, this PR battle thing is interesting now. So am I getting this right? Is the sympathy, if not moving to the Kilmacud side, moving away from Glenn over the last few days? I saw this piece by Tommy Conlon in the Indo where he eviscerates them, having done their best to take the good out of it for the winners. The vanquished scuttled away from the mess they'd created when the penny dropped that they were starting to look like poor losers. Is that kind of widely held?
Judging by Tommy's mentions, I would say not widely held at all. I don't know that that's what's happened. But I mean, for all of the chatter, it just kind of seems quite unsatisfactory, you know, that there, you know, it wasn't a kind of, you know, calmer heads prevailed or the GA showed leadership or, you know, the GA's disciplinary proceedings were seen to be fair and even-handed to all parties.
Nobody's happy with Crokes, nobody's happy with Glenn, and nobody's happy with the GA.
Ah, no, some people are happy with Glenn. Some people are happy with Glenn, I think, you know? I mean, leaving aside the statement, I suppose the action of withdrawing from the process will, I think, probably gain them some... maybe not even gain them some acolytes, but they might hold on to some of the acolytes that they had. But I mean, to the broader question on what has been learned here? What can we take from this? Absolutely nothing, on. This is a mess with no easy resolution, no pointers as to future behaviour. It has just been a complete and utter shambles from the moment that Darragh Mullen didn't get the message or refused to leave the pitch or whatever the fuck happened in the last 3 minutes of the Ireland Club Football Final. Absolutely nothing has been learned, and we are singularly unprepared for the next time. And there will be a next time that this happens.
Crucially, everybody's a little bit unhappy, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no doubt about that.
You know
that.
The noises that came out of Crokes, you know, sources say that they'd rather hand the trophy back than play a replay, which we said, that's a risky one. You might have your bluff called on that one. But in a way, do you think that was part of calling the bluff on the other side? That this could be what's happened here, that Waddy Graham's realised, hang on a second, if we go all the way and win through the DRA and all that, Crokes aren't going to play this replay. We're just going to get the trophy and everybody will hate us. you know, we'll be All-Ireland champions by default. We don't want that either. So actually, this sort of these sources said stuff might have been a strategic masterstroke from Crokes. Reading too much into that?
Yeah, I mean, you could perhaps construct that argument on, but I mean, it did seem like quite incendiary language. And I don't think anything the Crook said would have any major impact on what Glenn had done, do you know? At the end of the day, I'm sure there wasn't unanimity in the Glenn club about how they were behaving.
Well, obviously, stuff the Crokes have done, I mean, they've pulled out of the process, a process that they started. So clearly something has happened. And
I would say that's either...
Well, it's not that much of a stretch, is it, to think that Crokes, that something has happened along the line here. So there's some reason that Glenn have pulled out of this process, and the thought that their opponents were being so bullish in their stance, and there was talk they weren't even going to play the replay anyway, must have factored into their thinking in some way.
I would say that unease amongst their own club membership and any legal advice that they may or may not have gotten outlining the likelihood or otherwise of their winning any appeal that might go to the DRA would be far greater impact than anything that Crokes... I mean, Crokes didn't even really say that. You know, like, that's you know, sources within the within Kilmacud or whatever said that. You know what I mean? So it's not like they can say, oh, well, Kilmacud chairman X or, you know, Kilmacud selector Y said these words, and that's...
No, but that's how the media game works, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
People sometimes don't want to go on the record, but they don't mind the message getting out there.
Yeah, yeah. To be honest, I wouldn't see that as being a major factor in anything that Glenn may have done. And to be honest, I don't even want to overblow the idea that they might have gotten a suggestion that any DRA appeal would be unsuccessful, because at the end of the day, these things are decided by clubs, and you know, players and management can be extremely bullish in the, you know, 72 hours or 96 hours after a game, but they have to live with those decisions and they have to be 100% confident that what they're doing is the right thing. And, you know, like, I would be shocked if 100% of the Glenn members, it's not even like the full membership, it's like the executive committee and the manager and the coaches and the players. I'd be shocked out of my mind if 100% of them were in agreement last Wednesday or Thursday when they lodged the appeal. And the more and more that the talk swirled, and they got tons of support, of course, you know, but there would also have been dissenting voices from within, and, you know, maybe just that's what happened, you know, that they just kind of said, the longer this goes on, the more unlikely it is that we get what we want from this, and, you know, maybe it's just better to pull out now. So, no ending to this was good, you know, and from the moment it happened, it was a mess, and it finished in a mess, so we should hardly be surprised at that.
2 weeks later, pretty much, yeah. All right, that's it. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you very much, Owen, and to you, Simon. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday.
Thanks, Owen. Thank you, Murph.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to sign up to the World Service for ad-free podcasts and for Ken's Football Pod tomorrow. Second Captain's Podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Ah!
Which phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.